And so there's a lot of strategies. There's not a single solution. There are many solutions that create a big solution, and you have to work at it. So because we have saved the county so much money, they were generous enough to help pass a bond. And the idea was to build a one-stop shop for the most acutely ill that keep cycling.
More than 2 million arrests in the U.S. each year involve people with serious mental illness, half of which are homeless at the time of their arrest. Judge Steve Lifman of Miami-Dade in Florida will discuss the essential elements necessary to create an effective system of care that ultimately will transform the mental health and criminal justice systems and make jail the last option for people with SMI, not the first. And it works. Judge Lifman is our guest. Welcome to our podcast, Schizophrenia, Three Moms in the Trenches. From the place where schizophrenia and real life collide.
East Coast, West Coast, Middle America.
With Miriam Feldman, Mindy Greiling, and Randy Kay.
This is episode 82. We have been waiting such a long time to have our guest on. We're going to bring him on very, very quickly. The title of this episode is Ending the Criminalization of Mental Illness. And our guest will be Judge Steve Lifman. He's Associate Administrative Judge of the Miami-Dade County Court Criminal Division. If you're a longtime listener, you may have heard us talk about him on many, many programs as we've spoken about this as one of the issues, one of the many issues facing families with mental illness. If you're just joining us for the first time, brand new listener, as they say in the podcast world, I'm Randy Kay. I'm here with Miriam slash Mimi Feldman and Mindy Greiling. We are three moms, authors, advocates for our sons who all have schizophrenia, and we want to make you feel not quite so alone. So happy new year, guys. I don't think we've done anything in January. Yes.
We had a hiatus.
We had a little unofficial hiatus. So happy, very belated new year to both of you. Anything new and exciting? Anything briefly new and exciting before we bring on Steve?
Nothing terribly exciting, but our daughter came this past weekend to Minnesota for her very first lutefisk dinner. We are not Scandinavian and we are not Lutheran, but we went to a Lutheran church. Everybody had on their Scandinavian sweaters and she had lutefisk for the first time because she managed to avoid it all these times. So that was exciting.
I don't know what lutefisk is. What is lutefisk?
Oh, it's a cod or whitefish that Swedes were, in the old days, when they didn't have refrigeration, they were poor, they soaked it in lye, it kind of dried it out, and then you have to reconstitute it, and then you cook it and serve it with white sauce and butter, and if you smother it in those two things, you can actually eat it. but then she was home then for 4 days and she did observe that her brother was very challenging. You know, we're kind of into first world problems now. We aren't dealing with jail anymore, although Jim has been there three times and we are still waiting to expunge his record, which he will become eligible for in August from the last time he was in district court charged with a felony. But got knocked down to a gross misdemeanor. But Angela, the caregiver that we've discussed a few times was worried and felt like she should be taking notes on what's going on with her brother because he's had dizziness and falls and some seizures, which we're not sure if it's inner ear or if it's a mixture of of his clozapine and anti-seizure medications. But in any case, we had the high of Angela being here, the lutefisk, and then the constant worry that we have. And she shares more now that she's older about her brother.
And the fun never ends. But as you said, you've been in worse places before. So wishing you strength and love as always. Mimi, how are you guys?
We're status quo, which is always a good thing. No complaints. As long as it's not a dip, I'm okay.
Yeah, we'll take a life without the dip. We're okay. I'll say a little bit more about Ben when we bring on our guest, because I think where we are, if you're a new listener, my son, who I call Ben for purposes of publicity. That's not his real name, but that's the name he chose and is letting me use. So I'm happy with that. And he is currently, we're still waiting for a bed in a jail diversion program. But I talk to him every day. I see him once a week. I enjoy my conversations with him. So it's okay for now. It's one day at a time. It's one day at a time. And yeah, you know what? Let's bring on our guest and get to it, because we have dealt in past episodes a lot about criminalization of mental illness. Do you know that more than 2 million arrests in the U.S. each year involve people with SMI, serious mental illness? Half are homeless at the time of their arrest. That is a huge statistic. As a result, we've got some untrained and unprepared stakeholders in the criminal justice system. And as we did on our episode with Elisa Roth, who wrote an entire book about this, among other wonderful books, they're navigating a really scarce system of care for people with mental illness. Everybody we've spoken to has said, you have to speak to Judge Steve Lifman, the Associate Administrative Judge in the Miami-Dade County Court Criminal Division. Many awards, many accolades, and subject of the documentary, The Definition of Insanity, which appeared nationally on PBS on April 14th, 2020. We are really going to talk with you, Steve, about your journey into the mental health system, how it got there, and what you've been doing to help in Florida. And we're hoping all the other 49, well, in Miami-Dade County, we're hoping all the other states and counties will listen and learn. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. And before I get started, the lutefisk sounded like gefilte fish. And we smother it with horseradish to make it edible. So we all have our...
Our quirky things. Yeah, well, that you have to smother some of these things or you can't eat them. Also, before we start, I have to say, you know, I was, of course, impressed with everything you've done. And I hadn't realized how many awards you've gotten until we were preparing for this meeting. And I've never met anyone that got an award from the Pope that you got just last fall. So could you just tell us a minute about that? Did you go over there to receive it?
No, they delivered it here through the Archbishop. It was pretty humbling, and you know, you don't do any of this for any kind of award, but I will say that getting recognition from the Pope was a real highlight. And it also opened more doors for us to be able to continue the work. So to get that kind of blessing, you might say, from him, that this is an important area, made it that much more worthwhile. Our Archbishop here in Miami-Dade, Archbishop Winsky, is an amazing human being. He nominated me, apparently, for this recognition. I had no idea. As I tell my friends, not bad for a Jewish guy. I had no idea it was coming until I got a call from the Archbishop's office. And they had a ceremony at the 65th anniversary of the Miami Archdiocese. And then it's a medal. It's been given for 100 or so years. And then they flew the medal and the proclamation that comes with it over. And then I had a private lunch with the Archbishop, and it was pretty stunning and very heartwarming and very appreciated.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
That's wonderful. So let's find out why you got this award. We're all very excited to talk to you. I usually like to ask guests before you tell us the fuller version of the story, what would you most want our listeners, and our listeners are, you know, people who have schizophrenia, families of people who have schizophrenia, and practitioners as well. What would you most want people to know about your work before you tell us a fuller version of the story?
That this is a fixable problem, that we should not accept the status quo. It was not designed this way. It came about this way because some of it well-meaning, some of it not so well-meaning, but it does not have to stay this way. And I'm actually extraordinarily optimistic because the Conference of Chief Justices and the Conference of State Court Administrators, for only the third time in their history, have taken on an issue, because we don't do issues, we're not policymakers. But because this issue has such a profound impact on the administration of justice, that they have adopted basically what we call the Miami model. And every chief justice in the United States is working to change the system. And so I'm hopeful. And it's going to take time. As we like to say, we are a 24-year overnight success. I don't think it'll take that long because we now have a model, we have data, we have research, and we're teaching other courts how to work with other policymakers to make it happen. And I am in an airplane about once a week, meeting with chief justices who are holding these statewide summits, and they're bringing their governors and their speakers of the House and Senate presidents, and they're working together to modernize and reform the system. So we don't have to accept it. It's wrong. And we should be a little angry that we've allowed it to get to this point, and let's not accept it.
I love that. And speaking of angry, I'll fill you in a little bit. On the really positive side of things, we had a guest on a few episodes ago, Kevin Early, son of Pete Early, mm-hmm. whose whole life was pretty much changed by being brought into a jail diversion program. So he is certainly a success story. It wasn't in your state, but that you can see that jail diversion can really, really work.
Well, Kevin's dad, Pete, wrote the book, Crazy, which is about Miami-Dade.
Right.
You know, yeah. Work here in Miami. So I'm very familiar with Kevin and Pete and our dear friends, and I just have such respect for the two of them.
And absolutely.
Pete helped put us on the map and helped us get to where we are.
And so those of us who have read that book, and many of our listeners have, know what challenges you had to work with and how far you've come.
Absolutely. So to put it in the other end of the perspective, I currently have a son who for the first time in his life is not in prison, but in jail. It's pre-trial. And he has been there without any, obviously he hasn't had a trial, he's not convicted of anything. He's been there since August 2nd. And it took a while for each court date. And then we had some work to do. We collected letters of reference about his character, and everybody came through with them. And a couple of court dates later, it was approved by the prosecution, or intended prosecution, and by the state, I guess, by the state and by the judge. Everyone said, yes, now we just need a bed to open up. Well, he's 13th on the waiting list in a facility that has 26 beds. And he went back to court today, and they're like, well, we don't know. Your next court date is April 2nd, in case you don't get a bed yet. So he's really trying to be positive and say, you know, I'm doing my best, but, and he's safe and he's sober, and I'm very grateful for both of those things. But I'm grateful that my state, Connecticut, has a jail diversion program, but it is difficult to deal with the lack of bed space.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we are. So tell us about your, you know, what brought you to this work, and tell us what you were facing and what you did about it. And then we'll just let the conversation flow.
So first, I'm sorry you're going through this, and I'm sorry Ben is going through this. It's unfortunate. Part of what we are doing is educating judges. I co-chair a national organization called the Judges Psychiatrist Leadership Initiative. And we have been training a judge and a psychiatrist in every state to do ongoing training to teach judges and policymakers how to make changes. And one of the things that we are teaching them is that you don't want to leave people with these serious illnesses in jail too long unnecessarily, because the data is bad, that it makes people worse. the percentage of people in jail and prisons with serious mental illnesses that have serious histories of trauma is huge. And many will get re-traumatized while they're in custody too long. And for people that are low to moderate risk of reoffending, longer term incarceration actually makes recidivism much, much worse. And so they don't realize that in some ways that they are endangering public policy by doing things the way they're doing it, not improving it. And so part of this is educating people that want to do the right thing, how to do it in a way that'll be more effective and enhance our public safety, not endanger it. So wish your son luck. Tell him, you know, there is light at that end of that tunnel, and that there's no reason that he can't have a fulfilling and happy life with hope and opportunity. And that should be all of our ultimate goal for the population that comes into our system. And when you do that, everybody wins. It's less expensive for the taxpayer. It improves our public safety, and we help people recover. I mean, how perfect is that? And the way we do it now has the opposite impact. And so my story, I have two of them, but I don't want to take up all 45 minutes, so I will shorten them both. But combined is what led me, I believe, to where I am today. When I was 17 years old, I was an intern for a state legislator in Florida. And he received a letter from the then editor of the Miami Herald about a young man who was in our state hospital that was not being treated well, and they weren't sure needed to be there. And so being the lowest person on a totem pole, I got selected to go to a state hospital. My age totally corresponds to deinstitutionalization. So 17 years old, this must have been 40 something years ago. And if I look back, I kind of laugh and I scratch my head. I would never allow my 17-year-old to go into a state hospital. I don't know what they were thinking. And it was a little traumatizing. You know, I grew up in a nice middle-class family. I never saw anything bad in my life until I walked through those doors. And I found the young man that I was there to see. He was in all four-point restraints. He was probably 100 pounds overweight from the Thorazine that they were injecting him with. And he was screaming and moaning, and it was a scene out of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And because it was all pre-HIPAA and all those kinds of things, I looked at his records, I talked to the staff, and even as a 17-year-old who knew absolutely nothing, when I learned that he was autistic and not psychotic, I realized how horrific the situation was. And while I was there, fortuitously, there were a group of advocates at the facility that day, and they heard that there was a representative from a legislator's office, albeit a 17-year-old with little knowledge, little wisdom, and no power. And they took me on a tour, and they took me downstairs. And I remember like yesterday, because it looked like a dungeon. And there were seven men lying naked in their own feces while a guard stood there with a hose, and he washed them down like animals in a zoo. And it had quite a profound impact on me. I remember it like yesterday. 17, 16 years later, I was appointed to the bench. That hospital that I was at closed, and those same folks were now in my jail. And so the young man that I went to see, we got out, and he ended up having a really good life for someone with his level of autism. But my jail, when I started as an assistant public defender, had one wing of one floor housing people with mental illnesses. When I became a judge, there were three of nine floors housing people with mental illnesses because that hospital closed. And everything just got transferred over, not directly, but indirectly. And so one morning, fairly soon after I had been moved over to the criminal division, I was handling what we call a misdemeanor jail division. A misdemeanor jail division has three kinds of people. So these are people charged with low-level offenses who are still in custody. So some of them are there because they have a attach serious felonies and they're not allowed out of custody. Some of them are there because they're too poor and they cannot afford to bond out of custody. But mostly, it's people with serious mental illnesses that don't know how to get out of custody. I had no training. Judges in Florida at the time had zero training. And so my training went something like this from the judge whose division I took over. She said, Steve, if they act strange or bizarre, order a psychological evaluation. Somewhat pejorative, but that's what they did. And I didn't even know what I was supposed to do with the evaluations when they came back. I'm not kidding. So I get assigned to this division, getting ready to go on the bench one morning. I'm approached by the assistant public defender and the assistant state attorney. And they come to my chambers and say, Judge, there's a couple in court. Their son is in jail on a case. It's an unbelievable situation. And if it's okay, we'd like the parents to speak with you. So this lovely couple came into my chambers. They were very sophisticated. They looked like they were probably relatively well off. And they were just horribly distraught. The mom was crying. The dad was shaking. And they started to beg me to get their son help. They told me that he had gone to Harvard. He had a late onset of schizophrenia. He was now homeless. And he was cycling through the criminal justice system. And they just didn't know what to do. And I'm sure, tragically, this story will sound very familiar to the three of you.
Mm-hmm.
They had tried to civilly commit him several times. Of course, that didn't do anything but make it worse and make him hate them. He had been in and out of all kinds of civil attempted treatment. Nothing worked. And they were actually hopeful that since he got arrested, that maybe he'd get real treatment this time. And so I was pretty new. And I think when you're a new judge, you think you have a lot more wisdom and a lot more power than you really do. And I made a rookie mistake. And I promised them that I would get their son help because I deal in logic. And I knew logically that if someone got arrested and they had a heart attack, we wouldn't let them die on a jail floor cell. We would immediately get them emergency care and get them help. So logically, I concluded that if someone got arrested and they were in serious crisis, we wouldn't let them die on a jail floor cell. We would get them treated immediately as well, because that would be the humane and logical thing to do. Well, turned out I was pretty naive and wrong. We were allowing people with serious mental illnesses to die on our jail floor cells. So we started to go back into the courtroom and the mom stopped me and said, Judge, there's one more thing I need to tell you about my son. She said, not only is he brilliant, but respectfully, he probably knows more about the mental health system than you do. Which I looked at her, I had no idea what she was trying to tell me. And I think she thought that the lawyers had told me the whole story. They had not. And I looked at her and I said, excuse me. And she said, oh, you see, my son is the former head of psychiatry at Jackson Memorial Hospital.
Oh, my gosh.
Yep. And that was my reaction.
Whoa.
And I was really taken back. And I was more than ever committed to trying to get him help. So we went into the court and I called his case. Now, mind you, I don't remember the exact charge, but I am pretty sure it was some ridiculous local county ordinance that homeless people get picked up on. And I want to intercede there. It's not as nefarious as most people think, because the police also often think that if they can get these folks arrested, they can get them treated.
Mm-hmm,
they're
right.
Not doing it necessarily just to clean up the street from homeless people.
Right. Or if it's cold in Minnesota.
Right.
It's cold.
Correct. Or there's a hurricane coming, you know, here. So anyway, it's not as nefarious as people think. And so he's in on this ridiculous charge. We start to have a conversation and he's great. He's coherent. He's thoughtful. He's more respectful than the lawyers. And He seems fine, except when you looked at him, he looked like a homeless guy that hadn't bathed in months. And he kept insisting there was absolutely nothing wrong with him, that he did not have any type of mental health disorder. He told me that if I would just release him, he would go see a psychiatrist, get evaluated, and come back. I'd see he's fine. He also told me, which I got a kick out of because he was right. He said, Judge, this is a ridiculous charge. Even if I did do it, no one goes to jail for it. And you have really dangerous people in Miami. So why are you using a cell up with me when someone dangerous should be in here? And his logic was flawless.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to him, can I ask you a question? He said, sure, Your Honor, anything. I said, I just don't understand one thing. You keep insisting that you don't have any type of mental health disorder, that there's nothing wrong with you. But if that's the case, why would a Harvard-educated psychiatrist be homeless and cycling through the criminal justice system? Well, all of a sudden, he got a look on his face that I will not forget to the day I die. He started cupping his ears. He started, you know, self-soothing himself. And then he started rocking back and forth. And he went into a full-blown psychotic episode. And he started screaming at the top of his lungs. And everything he screamed was in sixes. And he started screaming, Your Honor, Your Honor, Your Honor. You have to have that couple removed. You have to have that couple removed. And he was pointing to his parents. And I said to him, aren't those your parents? No, 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 no. My real parents, real parents, real parents died, died, died in the Holocaust, 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 Holocaust. And they are from the CIA, CIA, CIA. And they came to kill me, kill me, kill me, kill me, kill me. And the only thing that you could hear in that courtroom was his poor mother crying. And the only stupid thing that I had been told to do was to order a psychological evaluation. Now, it took me some time to figure it out. He never told me that he was a Harvard psychiatrist. And I think that the second I asked him that question, which I would never do again, made him conclude that I must have been part of the CIA conspiracy, because how else would I have known that he was a Harvard educated psychiatrist?
It made sense to him, I'm sure.
100%. And it also scared him, because the one person that he thought he could trust in the courtroom was the judge. And I let him down. And he ended up spending 12 weeks on possession of a dairy cart, all three evaluations, because that's what I needed at the time for a competency evaluation, came back and said that not only was he incompetent to stand trial, but that he met Florida's ridiculously high standard for civil commitment, that he was imminently dangerous to self or others. And I was thrilled. I'm like, this is great. I'm going to get him treated. I'm going to be a hero. I'm going to fulfill the promise I made to his parents. I handed the evaluations to the lawyers, and I noticed the assistant public defender grinning, which I knew was bad. And then she says to me, Your Honor, in all due respect, when a lawyer says that to a judge, it has nothing to do with respect. And so I said, excuse me. And she whipped out a Florida Supreme Court opinion that had come out relatively recently that I had not seen yet. And it said that because this was a county court case and it was a misdemeanor, I had no authority to civilly or criminally commit him anyway. And I had to release this floridly psychotic man, imminently dangerous to self or others, back to the street. And so not only did I not fulfill the promise I made his poor parents, I put him at risk, I put the community at risk, and I probably put my job at risk. God forbid something terrible happened. And it was a window to absolutely everything that was wrong with both the criminal justice system and our response towards people with mental illnesses, and to the civil commitment system and the community mental health system that had no clue how to deal with this population. And that's how my story began.
All right. So in one story, it reflects so much of the problems that are universal in this segment that we're in. So what did you do? So you went from, so that's your motivation. And obviously you've had a career of making changes. So, you know, what changes did you make? And
yep.
You
Well,
know,
first of all, it's good to be judged because, you know, I think, what's his name said, it's good to be king. Well, it's good to be a judge. And when we invite people to meetings, they come even when they don't want to be there. But before we got to that point, fortuitously, the first national meeting on this topic was in Miami that year, like a month later, 2 months later. And I went, and it was put on by SAMHSA, you know, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, and what was known as the GAIN Center back then, Policy Research Associates from upstate New York. They were doing the leading work. And it was like going to a religious revival. There were people actually speaking a language I understood. They were coming up with best practices and solutions based on research and data, and that they were telling us this could be fixed. And I brought a bunch of them over to see my jail, talked to them about the problem, and they were kind enough to give me their last grant that year. And I invited all the traditional and non-traditional stakeholders to a two-day summit. And we mapped out the intersection between the criminal justice system and the community mental health system. And what we found is that we were embarrassingly dysfunctional, not the people with the illnesses, that we were the ones that needed help more than the people that were sick, because we had a so-called healthy sane people had designed and developed a system to fail perfectly, and it perfectly failed. And it's very expensive doing it the wrong way. And I remember vividly being in that room for those 2 days, and at one point looking at each other and asking who's more ill, because it was embarrassing. And no one did it on purpose. It's not nefarious. This isn't a system that was designed to torture people. It is just a perfect storm that came together, and we're using the same system that was in place 60 years ago when there were very few people with mental illnesses in the criminal justice system. And what most people do not understand, because this is no one's fault, you can't point fingers to a party, a person, or an institution. And it's not going to be one party, one person, or institution that's going to fix it. This requires a tremendous collaboration between all the different stakeholders and all the different governmental entities. And when community mental health was designed in this country, the individuals with the most acute illnesses were still in hospitals, mostly the psychotic population. And so community mental health was designed for moderately ill people, not acutely ill people. And so when we closed the hospitals, like the one in South Florida, we went to the war on drugs and crime. When we cut back housing massively in the 80s, and when we went to sentencing guidelines, all of this created the perfect storm. And this population ended up going to our communities without a system that was designed to help them. And so what do? We end up blaming the providers, who are frustrated because they don't have a system for this population. And even worse, which galls me the most, is we blame people who are sick when we don't offer them the right services to begin with to help them recover. And we punish them. And so we have used a criminal justice model for an illness, and nobody should be shocked. Reminds me of that line from Casablanca, shocking. No one should be shocked that it has failed, because it was never designed this way. The problem is there's no one entity or person or institution that's responsible for this. And so this population tends to access the high-end services from every different system. And then they just cycle between hospitalization, homelessness, jail, competency restoration, again and again and again. And everyone's doing their job.
Mm-hmm.
But
we've talked a lot in this podcast about coordination of care. And so I loved, and we could talk about the problems with the system for another half an hour, but I would love to maybe get to what you did, what the solution has been, you know, how it works, you know. I know you have more to say about the system, and so do all.
No, it was a perfect segue. Yeah. So thank you for moving me, because that's what I was going to tell you next.
Okay.
So what we did is we decided we needed a two-part approach. If I were to do this again, it would be a three-part approach. But we broke into some subcommittees. We met for another 90 days, and we put together a written collaborative agreement. Didn't need any new laws. We didn't even need any money initially. We needed a new system. And we could do it through collaboration if everybody would agree. And everybody agreed, and we started very small. And we agreed to start with nonviolent misdemeanor cases. The two-part approach that we put together was a pre- and post-arrest diversion system. This was not about developing a mental health court. They're actually not that effective if they're done wrong and they handle too few people. We wanted a system change. And we wanted it institutionalized so people got used to doing it this way, so you don't think twice ever again about doing it the old way. And that's what's happened. It has been in a complete and total cultural shift. Now, we looked around the country, and to us at the time, the best system for pre-arrest was the Memphis Model Crisis Intervention Team Police Program, which I'm sure all of you are familiar with. 40-hour training, great program. 24 years later, there are other models that may be just as effective or more effective. It's kind of funny or ironic. We're trying to get our law enforcement to look at some co-responder changes. And at first, they didn't want to do CIT at all. Now they don't want to give any of it up. So, but they've been heroic. And the pre-arrest diversion has succeeded, and the post-arrest, way past our wildest dreams. We have over 8,600 officers trained at all 36 of our police departments. We have a 9/11 call taker training for 16 hours. We have a 4 to 5 hour training for every police chief and major to teach them how to run it. And then we have the 40 hour training for the patrol officers. And it's a percentage. We follow the fidelity model of CIT. And it's amazing. Since we fully implemented CIT in Miami-Dade, the number of arrests went from 118,000 a year overall in Dade County to 53,000 before COVID. It's lower after COVID, but we don't use that because that's misleading. Our jail audit went from 7,400 to 4,400. The CIT program alone has saved Dade County 400 years of jail bed days, years. We closed one of our three main jails at an actual savings, not cost shift, of $12 million a year. It's now been closed 11 years. That's $132 million in true savings. And a couple other things happened that we had not anticipated. And this is important, particularly for like Minneapolis. Our police shootings almost stopped. And we recently looked at some studies we did, and we looked at police shootings the 5 years before CIT for one department, City of Miami. There were 90 shootings. The 5 years after CIT went to 30, and the last 5 years, it's down to like 12 or 13, I think. And what happened that we had not anticipated was the level of PTSD among law enforcement is through the roof. Last year, more police officers died from suicide than in the line of duty. They will not go to their departments for help for all the obvious reasons. So the woman that runs my program, Hopsy Kaba, who is amazing, she's been running CIT. She works for the court for, gosh, 20 years now. She gets about 250 calls a month from police officers for their own personal mental health issues. So not only do they have high suicide rates, they also have high domestic violence rates, high substance use rates, and high divorce rates. And a lot of it is PTSD. Some of it they are coming in with from military combat duty. Some are traumatized before they even got to combat. or they are getting PTSD on the job. It's a very stressful job and they see horrible things. And so what we did is we went to the Police Chiefs Association and we said, you got a problem. You may not be aware we're getting these calls. So we set up a treatment program for law enforcement outside the department. And we don't have to report it unless the officer is suicidal or homicidal. And the police love it because they were so afraid of losing their jobs or their promotions, being ridiculed. You know, you think stigma is bad. Try having a mental health issue in a police department.
Mm.
And so they have totally embraced us. You're now the cool cop in Miami if you get punched by somebody with a mental illness and don't arrest. And you're kind of the wimp if somebody with a mental illness touches you and you arrest them. And we can see it in our data. It's staggering.
So there's a lot of training and help, crisis intervention training and help for PTSD for the officers. Can you tell us more about someone like my son? You know, someone who, you know, what have you done for the people who do get arrests? And so that's a free arrest. I totally get that.
But it's also possible if they had realized he had a serious mental illness up front.
Right.
They may never have arrested him and just taken him to a crisis stabilization unit and done a pre-arrest, which is what we prefer.
I agree. That would have been great.
So that would have been step one. And honestly, I believe there should be a minus one or a zero intercept under the sequential intercept mapping. That we need to be doing more on trauma much earlier and identifying kids that have serious histories of trauma and getting them treated and maybe keeping them from ever coming in. But nonetheless, that would be one. Two is we set up a post-arrest diversion program. We changed the screening tool at the jail because it turns out most jails don't use a validated tool to screen people for mental illnesses. So if you are screened, let's start with a misdemeanor, and you are identified as having a serious mental illness, you're segregated into a much better part of the jail. We closed down what we refer to as the forgotten floor, which was the ninth floor of the Dade County Jail, which was worse. You wouldn't put your dog in there. Horrible. And they're segregated. They're seen by a psychiatrist within 24 hours of the arrest. And if they meet criteria for our civil commitment, which we call the Baker Act, the doctor signs what's called a professional certificate. So if your son came in and he was floridly psychotic, and he was meeting criteria, psychiatrist would issue a professional certificate. And one of my judges, and then he would be evaluated to make sure and assessed to make sure, A, he met criteria, but B, that he had no communicable illnesses. And we did this even before COVID. So that's, we already had the protocols in place. You know, we don't want to send people out with hepatitis or other issues that could be a community risk. And so they're blood tested, they're checked. If they pass that screening, well, one of my colleagues or me signs a transportation order. And this happens within 3 days of the arrest. This is a misdemeanor. And our Department of Corrections acts as our Department of Transportation. And within 3 days, they are transported from the jail to a crisis stabilization unit. We have several in Miami. All of them signed this collaborative agreement that they would take this population. And they also all agreed when we signed this 24 years ago that they would be willing to hold the person for up to 2 weeks because they're on a criminal hold. The 72 hours of our civil commitment law does not apply. People need to understand they're very confused about what that 72 hours means. People think you can get cured of their serious mental illness in 72 hours. All the 72. You know,
we know that does not happen, and our listeners know that does not happen. That's quite different from what Randy's son is going through in Connecticut. So kudos to you. And I have a question. You mentioned Minneapolis, and you were in Minneapolis 3 years ago or so, and we were inviting you as a national treasure, a national expert, and with a lot of wisdom and experience, and with the rubber meeting the road. And then there were people in Minnesota who said, why are we needing to listen to Florida? You know, and you cite, as you know, in some of the information that you sent us, that, you know, Florida doesn't have a very good track record in general for its mental health system. It's pretty awful. So there you are, you know, with this wonderful program, kind of an oasis amongst all this other dysfunction in the mental health system. So my question for you is, what do you say to those who, you know, criticize Florida in general, like some people here in Minnesota did when you were here, to my chagrin? And
it's then, okay. I criticize Florida all the time. So one thing has nothing to do with the other.
Okay.
Because this isn't two things I would say. There are like a bunch of essential elements every community needs to help fix this. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter what state you're in. And people, I believe, tend to overly, I'm not sure what the right word would be, but treatment is only part of what needs to happen. Okay. People need to get a life. And just institutionalizing someone or putting them in a facility for a month isn't going to fix this. Maybe it will stabilize them and it will be the good beginning that they may need. But there are a whole bunch of other pieces that are very inexpensive that, in my opinion, are equally, if not more effective, and helping someone get into recovery, like peers. Okay. Until COVID, 8 of my 24 member staff were people with lived experiences, and 4 of them were graduates of our program. What happens for many people that come into the criminal justice system with serious mental illnesses, that they have what's called learned helplessness. The system has beaten them up so badly, and I don't care if they're in Connecticut or Minnesota, I'm not sure where Feldman's from, but the system beats them up, both physically and emotionally. And so by the time they end up in a criminal justice system, it's not that they don't necessarily want to take their meds. In many cases, they don't want to care if they breathe. And the peers help them reestablish relationships. And Eric Kandel, the Nobel Prize winner in neuroscience, will tell you that one of the brain's primary functions is to develop relationships with other people. And when you don't get to do that, you become very isolated. It's kind of some of what we saw during COVID. And so we just figured out all of these pieces here. It had a lot less to do with Florida than listening to the people that actually understood these issues and following their instruction. I'm not a mental health provider, okay? And so that's what we were able to do. And so what happens, Randy, when the person gets transferred out of jail within 3 days, they get stabilized, and usually that 2 weeks, because what we have found is it takes about 2 weeks to really stabilize somebody. And we have leverage. And the leverage is, if you come into the program, you don't get rebooked into jail. And these people are sick. They're not stupid. They don't want to be in a hospital and they don't want to be in jail. And so all of our staff are trained in motivational techniques. They go over and visit with the person. They're in a much better environment. They're out of jail. They're usually starting to take medication because they don't want to be they don't want to be institutionalized. And then our staff says, look, how can we help you? And if you take the program, which is voluntary, we're not going to rebook you. You're going to go right to court. And guess what? When you get to court, the first person you're going to meet is your new peer. And he just happens to have been where you were 2 years ago. And he's going to have food for you, something to drink. He's going to have your medication. He's going to have your living facility. We've arranged for a place for you to live. He's going to have your medication. We have transportation. We're going to drive you there because the county gave us a car. And we're going to help you start your life over. And guess what? When you successfully finish this program, we're going to drop the charges so that you have no record. Because we don't want to criminalize your illness. And what we've done is we have taken a population health or a disease model, and we've applied it to an illness rather than a criminal justice model. And guess what
happened? Go ahead.
Within 2 years, the recidivism rate among our misdemeanor population went from 75% to
20%. Wow.
And the state attorney realized that if you want to improve public safety, you have to get people treated because they're going to
Does it take a Judge Lifman to do all of this? You know, you mentioned collaboration is everything. Obviously, you've done that. But that's the other thing I hear. You know, we don't all have a Judge Lifman, and he's kind of a god of some sort. So
I'm
what
no
do you
god.
Say to that?
I am a mere mortal. Trust me. Ask my family. Look, I am just lucky I am from Miami-Dade. And my circuit gave me the room to work on this. And what a lot of people don't understand is that in 2006, when Florida ran out of competency restoration beds, the Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court pulled me off of my docket assignment and assigned me to Tallahassee, to the Supreme Court, to work on this for 3 years. So it's all I did. And I had the real gods, the Supreme Court justices, you know, supporting it. So I had a lot of access. That's happening all over the country. There are pockets of success happening everywhere. I just got an email from Reno, Nevada, that they have implemented some of the Miami model, and they are so excited and how great it's working. And the National Center of State Courts does tours of our program every month, where chief justices and legislators and mayors and judges come for a two-day immersion, and we're teaching people how to do it. So I'm flattered, but please don't use me as an excuse not to do this, because it is fixable.
And that's what I would, because we're going to be at an hour in about 5 minutes. So I want
to, for the editing you're going to have to do now.
No. I'm not. That's the beauty of a podcast. I'm doing this. I'm not taking anything out. So no, we can do it. I mean, we try to keep it at 45, but we can go over, and we're not cutting to a commercial break at any time soon. It's so important, and it gives so much hope. So, Mimi, before I ask one more question, tell Steve where you're from and a little bit of input about the system in your state. That Nick has never been incarcerated, so you haven't
He's
had the
never
first
been incarcerated. Came close a bunch of times, but I'm from California, and that's where we were up until about 10 years ago, and now we're in Washington State. And it's very interesting to note the difference, at least in our experience. It's much, much better up here in terms of care, and that's because he has access to wraparound care, and there's an ACT team, and there's community intervention. And like you said, the biggest change and the biggest motivator for him has been peer counselors. And they utilize that a lot up here too. I'm just wondering, is there any sort of template for other states and other counties to do what you've done that we could access?
Yes, and I'll, if I didn't send it to you, I'll send it as soon as we're off. The National Center for State Courts put together this beautiful description of all of our programs. And I can also send you a grand jury report that was done along with a mayoral task force that I co-chaired that began to implement a lot of this. So I'll send you those three things. I think you'll find it very helpful. And
Would we be able to put links to those things on our show notes if people?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Go ahead.
And so it's not rocket science.
Collaboration.
It's right. It's using the moral authority of the court to bring people together, not pretending you have all the answers, listening, putting it in a written collaborative agreement and making people sign it so that they're obligated. We met every month for 10 years after we put that agreement to make sure it was working and fixing when it didn't. But it worked so well that we expanded it to all misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies. And we now have an alternative competency restoration program that is hugely successful. And we got the Florida legislature to expand assisted outpatient treatment to county court misdemeanor divisions. So we go into a civil hearing and we use AOT for people that are high users of criminal justice and mental health services, and we put them under an AOT order. And then we put them on a long-term injectable medication that they prefer that works magic, and they don't drop off after they stop taking a pill or two. And so there's a lot of strategies. There's not a single solution. There are many solutions that create a big solution. And you have to work at it, and you have to collaborate in each system. And this is why I should be a little disappointed with my friends from Minnesota, because not only am I a Floridian, I'm a Minnesotan. My dad went to was born in Minneapolis. My uncle was the rabbi in St. Louis Park. And I'm a huge Minnesota Viking fan. So they shouldn't be so critical of a fellow Minnesotan slash Floridian.
Well, not everybody.
It has nothing to do with Florida or me.
Minnesota has a lot of good things, but we do have a few mental health courts, and I was happy to hear you say one of the problems with them is they hardly take anybody, because our son did not get into mental health court. He got in once, not the second time he was sent to felony court. But I know our time is almost up, but I think we want you to talk about this new center that you're opening. And I'm especially interested in the fact that, because another criticism that I've heard of a lot of the diversion programs, including, you know, what you do, is that people have to commit a crime first. But this center, I understand that people just at risk of doing something can also be helped. So could you talk about the center and how does it work where people don't have to first be criminals?
They don't have to be arrested, though, to get into our program either. The pre-arrest diversion, the police are not arresting them, and they're getting sent directly to the community mental health program, where we then oversee to make sure that the person's getting a good level of services as well.
That's wonderful.
So this is the problem. So even after you do all this great stuff that we've done, it goes back to what I said earlier about the community system wasn't designed for the most acutely ill psychotic population. So even if you do everything that we've done, what we found is 20 to 30% of the population is still failing. They're still not succeeding. And we've tried everything, right? We've done all of this stuff that I've described. And look, a 70 to 80% improvement is huge, and we're very proud of it, but we didn't do this for a 70% solution. And so we realized that we needed something in between the community mental health system and a state hospital. And we needed a diversion facility, a one-stop shop facility that was unfragmented, had a high level of care all in one location, because most of this population can't get to the services if they're even out there. And most communities, if you're lucky, has one or two of these services, and there are several that they need. So because we have saved the county so much money, they were generous enough to help pass a bond. And the idea was to build a one-stop shop for the most acutely ill that keep cycling. So we do a lot of studies, and we did one with the University of South Florida. They have something called the Florida Mental Health Institute, and they can tell a community who the highest users of criminal justice and mental health services. And so we sent them 3,300 names of people that had been arrested over 5 years that had been diagnosed of having an SMI. And we said, tell us who the highest users are. Shockingly, they narrowed it down to 97 people, primarily men, primarily psychotic, primarily co-occurring, primarily homeless. These 97 people over 5 years were arrested 2,200 times. They spent 27,000 days in the Dade County Jail and 13,000 days at a state-funded psychiatric facility. I guarantee every community in the United States has a 97. We recently updated those numbers and we looked at those same 97 since 1985. Turns out since 85, they've been arrested 4,700 times and spent 97,000 days in the Dade County Jail. And all of this has cost tens of millions of dollars without any positive impact. So the idea was to take the high users first that are penetrating these deep acute systems without getting any improvement and focusing on them by having all the resources in one location. So we got the state to lease the county, ironically, the old competency restoration facility for $1 a year for 99 years. It's 181,000 seven-story square feet building. It's magnificent. We had a bond passed. We had to go back and get more because the county took too long. We have gutted it. We renovated it. We got our temporary certificate of occupancy 2 weeks ago. We basically have an anti-linoleum policy because we told the architect it needs to be warm and welcoming. So it's mostly tiles and woods, no primary colors. It's really a beautiful facility. It has a receiving facility for both addiction and mental health. It has a crisis stabilization unit. It has a short-term residential facility. It has a day activity program that'll be run by people with lived experiences to teach self-sufficiency and train peers. It also has what's called the living room model. It's a model we borrowed, stole from Arizona, thank you, Arizona, that is an engagement room that are for people that come into the facility, but they don't meet criteria for involuntary commitment. But they want to get help or they just want to hang out and we use it to engage. So it's what we call privacy without doors. So there's sleeping areas, but there's no doors. It's pretty neat. It also has a culinary supportive employment program. It will also have a couple other vocational educational opportunities, college degrees, high school degrees. It has a courtroom in the facility so we can manage both criminal cases if they have any pending, or we can do civil commitment hearings in the building if need be. It also has a primary health clinic, a dental clinic, an eye clinic, and a podiatry clinic. So that
dental clinic is one of my pet peeves. You know, the certified community behavioral health clinics, CCBHCs, they don't have dental. That is so huge that you included dental.
We know it, especially if we want to get people back on their feet. I mean, they need to feel good and look good. And it also has 208 beds of housing. And so the idea is to take people, you know, it's more than 97. We'll probably see about 9,000 a year. But to take people at that high level that keep cycling and help them break the cycle. And instead of kicking them to the curb, once we've adjudicated their case, we can gently reintegrate back into the community with all the supports they need to maintain. Plus, we're going to be using long-term injectables if they want to do that. There's a new one for 6 months. It's two shots a year. It's amazing. And so we will, and it's going to have a huge workforce development component. So we will be doing fellowships and internships in all the different disciplines so we could help train our own workforce because there is a terrible shortage of behavioral health experts in the country from psychiatry down. And it's going to have a massive research component. We're working with University of Miami, probably Columbia and New York, and a couple other institutions to research the heck out of this, both not just from clinical research, but system research, to show communities that, hey, doesn't matter they're from Florida, but that if you do it this way, you can get these outcomes.
Wow.
And
this is to find out more, it's MiamiFoundationForMentalHealth.org.
Yeah, I'll send you a link. That's the foundation that is raising funds for it.
Okay.
There's a great description of the project on that link, and that's a good place to go if they want more information.
That is so, you know, and if you're listening from another state, another county, and we have listeners all over the world, actually, the model is right there if you want to know. I mean, this is the power of vision and collaboration and listening and follow through.
Exactly. It's not rocket science, like I said.
It is magic. It is magic, though.
We have to get out of our own way and get out of our boxes. You know, look, I'm a judge. Everybody wants a judge. And the police are policing. The judge is judging. The prosecutor prosecuting. The defender defending. And not one person is looking at these poor souls who are going through every one of our resources without getting better. And so we got to stop it. Because we're the problem, not the solution, if we keep doing what we're doing. And that was the definition of insanity. And that's why Norm and Judy Ornstein named it that, because it wasn't that the folks with the illnesses are insane. It's the system is insane. And the people that put it together need to change.
And you were a star in that movie as well.
Well, thank you.
And that there's also a website for that. So that will be in the show notes. I can't thank you enough for all you've done, for all you're doing, and for joining us tonight. Any last minute, is there anything else you want the listeners to know about how they can get in touch with you or learn about these things? Or
you know, there's a couple things. And first, I want to thank the three of you. It cannot be easy to have to live the way you have to live with this situation, knowing that the system isn't built to really help. And your advocacy is heroic and admirable and incredible. And the courage that the three of you have is phenomenal. So thank you. And thank you for helping get the word out. I don't need people to contact me directly because you saw how hard it was for me to get back to you.
I know.
And I love you. So the best thing to do is there's a couple sites I will refer people to. One of them is the Conference of Chief Justices has a behavioral health link now, and they can get a lot of information on what their states might be doing. Two other resources are the Council of State Governments Justice Center that we work with our judges and psychiatrist leadership initiative. And that's also through the American Psychiatric Association Foundation. And the other is Policy Research Associates. And that's, I think, some of the best work is coming out of these organizations. And SAMHSA is doing a nice job with the Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics, and BJA is doing a nice job, but we're working with them. And I sit on a committee called ISMIC. It's a federal group. And we're talking about some really cool, interesting ideas on how to scale a lot of this stuff and how to make it easier for people to have a better system approach as opposed to a program approach. And so I'm telling you, in 10 years, we're going to see a very different system.
From your mouth to the ears of anybody that can make a difference. And you certainly are. Steve, thank you so much, Judge Steve Lifman. And you will send us some of those links. It's all in the show notes. If you're on YouTube, I probably put them on the screen as well. Just check the show notes. And those resources are for you. May the sanity spread. What?
I'll do it right away so I don't forget.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, have a great evening. Happy New Year. Although it seems like it was a year ago.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again.
Hey, thanks for joining us for this episode of Schizophrenia, Three Moms in the Trenches with Randy Kay, Mindy Greiling, and Miriam Feldman. To get in touch with us or to learn more about our books, please visit our websites at miriam-feldman.com, mindygreiling.com, or randyk.com.